tonight on Arena. Turner Prize winning artist Jeremy Deller about his community project, The Triumph of Music, and actors Nick Dunning and Nisha Dunbar on Abby Morgan's play at the Gate Theatre. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Jeremy Deller is a conceptual artist known for his boundary-breaking installations and spectacles, including the Battle of Orgreave, a reenactment of a standoff between miners and police during the 1984 miners' strike, and the Somme Remembrance, We're Here Because We're Here, which saw soldiers dressed in World War I uniforms literally materialise in railway stations around Britain. This is an artist who creates participatory experiences which dissolve those barriers that are often there between art and audience. Jeremy is currently in Derry at Guildhall Square, where he, along with community groups and musicians, are creating a work called The Triumph of Music, featuring the Armagh Rhymers and banner creator Ed Hall. Delighted that Turner Prize winning artist Jeremy Deller has torn himself away from the rehearsals of The Triumph of Music to talk to us about an event that is very much still under wraps, but I hope you're not going to be coy with me now just because things are under wraps, Jeremy, are you?
No, I will tell you anything you want. So just far well, away.
I was describing those two wonderful, two of many wonderful projects of yours, the Battle of Orgreave and We're Here Because We're Here. And we'll come back to the specifics of what you did there just to give people a sense of that. But the Triumph of Music, a community project, what is it about music that makes you have that word triumph so closely placed beside it? And what kind of triumph are you looking for here? What's involved?
That's a good question. Well, for me, I think it's personal. I think the way that music has changed my life and made my life a better place. And I think that's the case for most people. So I think it's the way that music can transform people's lives, but also societies. And they can music can point the way forward and give you an idea about what society could be at its best. That's what I think about music.
And is it, to some extent, or to what extent, do you think that it's the absence, not always, but certainly a lot of the time, the absence of words that actually allows music to do that?
I think that's a really good point. I mean, when you think about, you know, I work with brass bands and steel bands, and I'm working with big bands here. There's no lyrics to the songs when they play them. And also a lot of dance music, the lyrical content is usually not that important. It's the sounds that are being created and what that does to people, how it affects people. So I think that is a very good point. It's not about lyrical content or language or anything like that, or different languages. It's just pure in a way, the way it gets to your brain.
Yeah, it kind of gets to places that you can't intellectualise about because there are no words.
You know, the only thing that really to get me to cry is music. No other art form do I cry in front of, not even cinema. It's music that does it for me.
Wow, yeah, music gets you at a very deep level. In terms of what you're doing musically as part of The Triumph of Music, this project that you're involved in Guildhall Square in Derry, which you must know is a very potent historical spot in terms
of
that city.
Yeah. I know it. I mean, it's in the square, but it's also in the Guildhall. We're in the Guildhall. We're all over the building. We're sort of taking over the building, effectively, for the day. And, of course, yes, the history for me is very present, isn't it? It's on the walls. It's in the stained glass and so on. So it's, you know, it's quite, it's loaded, isn't it? It's like being in a church almost in that respect. You know, there's a full of meaning and stories and so on. But I think that's good to be in those spaces and do something different, something unexpected that 150 years ago, the people that built it would have had no idea that something like that would be going on. And it shows, you know, how things can change.
And I guess it shows that possibility that civic spaces and politically charged spaces can also be places of artistic endeavour, of artistic expression and of community artistic expression.
Absolutely. And I'm very interested in civic spaces and what we do in them and what the kinds of people that can go, and everyone can go there. You're all welcome, effectively. And I think we need more of that. And, you know, this is an event that's about enjoying something. It's not a protest in any way, but it's about people coming to the sharing the experience and enjoying it.
Tell me a little bit then about what actually, if people come along to partake in this, because I don't think you want them to just stand there and watch what's happening. And the involvement, first of all, Jeremy, of the Armagh Rhymers, I think this is something very close to your heart, this type of community and folk expression.
Oh, God, they're such a wonderful group of musicians. I've been spending the day with them today. It was so amazing just sitting around them. They just start playing traditional music, but they're working with the group of the Young Artist Programme, the young people from the Playhouse Theatre, and we've devised a story. And a lot of the time they wear these big heads, these sort of big wicker heads, and the story is basically for the young artists, they're wearing the heads and they're trying to find the party, the rave, effectively, which is what happened, 30 years ago, driving around trying to find an event like that. And the Armagh Rhymers are going to be walking through the streets playing songs and coming across these young people who would join the procession and get more and more people by the end of it. And we're performing in the shopping centre, doing little dances and stuff. And they arrive in the square, and in the square there's a big performance. And in the square we have a pop-up barn where local groups of young people are going to play. All these different bands are playing. Mm. They've all got fantastic names, by the way. I've just got the list here. It's just fantastic. So it's very, they're called Pseudonym, Disarm, Sunset Theory, Intuition, Backroom Bandits, who I've seen play, who are fantastic. And then inside we have an all-day party, basically, and a big recording studio that you can go and sort of get experience like making music and recording it, and an archive about Keltronic, who've been doing a festival for 25 years, and about dance, the story of dance music in Derry, effectively. So it's a ton of stuff. It's kind of a bit mad, and a big performance of dancehall classics by a band made up of different people from different bands called the Floor Fillers, we're calling them, playing absolute bangers. So
I love the name of the band, the Floor Fillers. Can we listen a little bit? Let's listen to a little bit of the Armagh Rhymers and the famous the Wren. And we'll let this run on because I want to get to the part where you hear the music, you hear the singing, and then you hear the little bit of speech, which I think helps things along here for sure.
Favour, we shall win. Room, room, me yelling boys. Give us room to rhyme, and we'll show you some activity this happy festive time. Active youth and active age never acted on the stage. And if you don't believe a word I say, enter in Biddy Funny, and she will clear the way.
Here come I, wee Biddy Funny. I'm the wee woman that collects the money. All silver, no brass.
A And that's just a little flavour of the Armagh Rhymers who will be part of the Triumph of Music, the project that Jeremy Deller, our Turner Prize winning artist, is talking to us about this evening here on Arena. And there's so much theatre across even that, whatever, 2 minutes or thereabouts that we listened to within all of that, Jeremy. But you touched on something when you were talking about, because there's an ancient feel to that, and there's a sense of, you know, that kind of folk tradition has been around for a long, long time. But I think you're interested in looking at how that speaks directly to contemporary audiences and to contemporary concerns.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about folk music is that it can adapt and change, and that's what we're doing here. You know, it's got such a strong sense of itself that they can experiment and do other things. But also those stories are classic stories, aren't they? When you think about the lyrics of folk songs and the stories of folk songs, it's basically, they're all about issues and emotions and personal relationships that are basically the same as pop songs.
Yeah.
Pop songs are really taken so much from folk music. It's, you know, the boy meets girl or jealous lovers or people being spurned, all those things as the classics of pop music as well, or partying or being sad or happy. So we owe it a lot. Mm. We owe folk music a lot.
And I guess, you know, that the Armagh Rhymers or the Straw Boys, as they are in different parts of the island, do you have an equivalent style of folk tradition in and around your own part of the world over in Britain?
Yeah, we do. We have mummers.
Yeah.
They're called mummers plays, and that's very similar. It's a cross between a play and music, and they're performed in public. And I think it was a way, often these plays were, and events were done to raise money, because they were performed in the winter months where you couldn't work on the farms and so on. But it's a very similar thing, and the music's quite similar. So there's definitely a connection. But in Britain, we sort of neglected, or in England at least, we really neglected our folk culture for a long time, and it was the butt of jokes.
Yeah.
Whereas I think in Ireland it was cherished and it was seen as something very special.
Yeah, well, it still happens on the 26th of December in many parts of the country, where the people who go around looking for the wren, depending on what part of the country that you're in. And I think your interest in William Morris and Morris dancing, in fact, is about has that art form been kind of pushed to one side and laughed at?
Well, it was for a long time, and it's kind of like about class issue within England, I would say, and a kind of metropolitan snobbery around the folk culture and our sort of almost embarrassment of culture that comes from the countryside, probably because we industrialised so quickly. But then there was this snobbery. But I can really honestly say in the last 10, 15 years, there's been so much interest in this culture, especially Morris dancing, because now there's lots of Morris troupes that are all female, they're queer Morris troupes. It just reflects society, basically, and they wear crazy clothes. I mean, it's really, it's very heartening, I think. Again, it shows that folk culture is best, is very resilient and can change and can adapt and can take it.
How important were brass bands in your young cultural life, and indeed in your throughout your cultural life? Because it strikes me that brass bands and versions of brass bands, which you like to use, are important.
Yeah. Well, I think going back to what you're talking about, civic life. Mm. I'm from the south of England. I'm from London, and there aren't many brass bands in London. It's really used to do. It's kind of industrial culture spawned brass bands, effectively, but you'd see them out and about, obviously, in marches and so on, and just at fetes and church events. But for me, it was really a symbol of sort of civic pride, which is something I'm very interested in. And obviously, Derry has a lot of that as well. Wow. And so it's something, I don't play an instrument. I'm absolutely incompetent, but I love being around musicians, talking to them and just watching them play and pick up instruments. And I was in a pub last night with some musicians playing. You know, I just love the atmosphere of being in rehearsals and so on, but I can't play, but I'm always amazed that people can, frankly. I'm glad they can as well.
Let's have a listen to a little bit of The Groove That Won't Stop, of real acid brass that we're going to get here. And people may recognise this from the soundtrack to the film for The Four Lions.
Thank you.
That is a little bit of the groove that won't stop from the fairy, the fairy brass band, and that, as I say, was in the film. Jeremy Deller, Turner Prize-winning artist, speaking to us tonight ahead of his project in Derry, The Triumph of Music. But the sound of the brass band there brought to whole new places in the way that it's that it's performed there. But it did strike me, you know, the origins, as you spoke about, Jeremy, before that piece of the brass band in the north of England, and your piece that I mentioned in the introduction, The Battle of Orgreave, an extraordinary reenactment of a scene from the 1984 miners' strike. Where, how, when did you, what, were you very young when you saw the scene, and how did it strike you, and why did you want to recreate it some, you know, two decades later almost?
Yes, so basically what it was, what I did eventually was restage a riot from the miners' strike, or a battle effectively. It's the famous footage. If you ever see footage of a miners' strike, you see footage of a huge field and the police pursuing miners on horseback and with dogs and snatch squads. And it was something I saw that footage as a child on TV when it was happening in 1984, and it stuck with me and it disturbed me. And it was a sort of kind of political moment of realization almost for a child or a young person to see that kind of violence meted out by the state on civilians effectively, and it really shocked me, and it stayed, like I said, it stays with me. And then later, if you're an artist, you have the opportunity sometimes to revisit something and make something from it, or look at it again. And that's basically what I did. I was very lucky to get a commission to remake it. I had 1,000 people doing it. So it was and a lot of them were members of reenactment societies. Some were former miners and their families, so it was a grand, big mix of people, very different kinds of people as well, doing it in a field for the public to watch.
And I can only imagine the power of perhaps some of those miners now, older men, or their young families now, young adults, young families at the time in the 1980s, and now young adults, what kind of power that must have brought to the event. But the other one that really struck me was, with this happened back in July 2016, World War One British Army soldiers, the way it was described was that they literally seemed, these men seemed to materialise. I think it was mostly in railway stations, was it, around Britain?
It started, I should just add, though, it wasn't soldiers. It was people dressed as soldiers. I wasn't
working
in the
pardon.
Army.
Yes.
Just to make, that's probably quite an important point, potentially. But it was people, young men mainly, dressed as soldiers, very accurately, from the First World War, commemorating the dead on the first day of the Battle of the Somme. So we worked with thousands of people, unannounced. They turned up at railway stations in the morning and then travelled through the country, effectively. They're in Derry and Belfast as well.
Yeah.
All over Scotland, Wales, throughout the body of the UK, as it is, as we'll call it. And so through the nations. And it's like a viral artwork, but like I said, unannounced. And they just hung out and looked at the public, and then they didn't speak, and then they disappeared at the end of the day, and that was it.
So, and your point of pointing out to me, and quite rightly, that this was contemporary, you know, young men and young women of 2016 that were in, well, men predominantly in this garb at any rate, because they were ordinary people who went to the Battle of the Somme. It's very easy to look back in history and think, oh, the heroes of the Battle of the Somme, but these were young men. These were young people who went out and were slaughtered, effectively. One thing I didn't ask you about, and I just want to finish up by asking you about, is the banner creator Ed Hall. I think a long-time collaborator of yours. Again, banners within the North, in particular, in this part of the world, can have a political potency. What kind of banners is Ed creating, and Ed and I presume community members from around Derry and the North are creating for this event?
He made a banner. He's made two banners specifically for Derry. One is the title. So it's like a title of an artwork, you know, as you'd see next to a painting in a museum, the title of the work. He's made a banner to title the work, The Triumph of Music. And he's also made a banner in conjunction with a lot of local groups and local people to represent Derry. So that's more elaborate. It's a painting, basically. But Ed has made thousands of banners in his life for causes that he sees fit for him in a way. But I mean, mainly left-wing, I would say, and he works for unions, but he's the most amazing person, one of the great artists, I would say, in what he's done and what he's achieved.
Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us on the programme this evening, and I'm sure you have to head back over to the Guildhall now.
And
continue with the rehearsals. So off
it's
you go.
Free tea and cake.
Absolutely, because it's a six-hour-long installation. Yeah. You might need a bit cup of tea and a bit of cake at some point during the day. Thanks for speaking with us this evening, Jeremy.
Thank you.
That's
bye-bye.
Jeremy Deller speaking to us about the Triumph of Music 6-hour live installation in the Guildhall Square in Derry, Easter Saturday, beginning at noon, runs through until 6 p.m. And yes, indeed, there will be tea and cake. Here we go. Love Song by Abby Morgan opens at the Gate Theatre in May. It's directed by David Bulger. Stars Nick Dunning and Ingrid Craigie as Billy and Maggie, an older couple reflecting on their 40-year marriage as her health begins to decline. Neisha Dunbar and Zara Devlin play William and Margaret, newlyweds, newly moved to the US. Nick Dunning and Neisha Dolan are with me in studio this evening. Nick, are we just saying... talking out loud during the ad break, as we were, that Love Song, I was really taken by how the script read. Now, you have to be careful because you have to work out, is this the older character or the younger character speaking, which would be crystal clear on stage, obviously, because you see the bodies there in front of you. But Abby Morgan, tell us a little bit about her. People will probably know her more from her TV work than from her theatre.
You might well do. I mean, you might know her from the TV. She's done shows like The Split, The Hour, wonderful stuff that she's done. I mean, she did this. She developed with Frantic Assembly, which is a physical movement company in the UK. Mm. But she did The Iron Lady as well.
The film. I think I spoke to her about that time.
Yeah, I oddly enough, I was in that, so I kind of did that, and that's how I first came into her. You know,
yes,
to become aware of her really in that way. She's a wonderful writer, extraordinary.
And Ingrid Craigie, who plays Maggie within this, I think had been part of Splendor, which is one of Abby Morgan's earlier plays.
That's right. And I'm not familiar with that one, but that sounds... Every time, you know, you talk about what's been going on in rehearsal, and we talk about a little something to do with Abby Morgan, we all get very excited because the writing that we get to deal with is just so... It's like masterful. There's something... Like you're saying, like, you know, there's little bits that you might read that might seem a little strange on the set, but when you see it, it's absolutely clear because she's tying in, she's sort of weaving these poetic ideas all together to create this absolutely extraordinary romantic love story that is just so beautiful.
Very beautiful. So, and heartbreaking.
Absolutely. It is, but also very, very funny.
Oh, yeah, very funny. Very funny in places. And Neisha, I suppose it is very important to point out, because we're talking about these older and younger selves. Reading it, yes, you might have to double check. But plays, which as I was saying, as the light went red, plays should be hard to read. And you responded, Nick, that... Yes, they should be, because otherwise, why would you have to go to the theatre? You could just read the play. Yeah. But Neisha, if you could explain the kind of the place that William and Margaret are at when we meet them in the play.
Yes.
They're there the whole time, but, you know, the two time frames are running in parallel with each other and overlapping each other.
Absolutely, yeah. And when we meet William and Margaret first, they have just arrived in America and they have just come into their new home, and it's kind of full of the exhilaration of coming to a new place and getting your new home, and it's full of joy and fun. And then we kind of track their story as they kind of face various hurdles and just go through their life in this new country, as William is a dentist and as he's coming to work for a dentist in a town in America, and then goes on to set up his own practice. But as it unfolds, the scenes in this beautiful way speak to each other.
Yeah.
And as Nick is saying, they're kind of woven together by Abby, so that you get this kind of intergenerational story that is just weaving itself together. And it's just, it's absolutely beautiful. And it's so much fun as well.
Yeah, I can. And in some ways, it did strike me reading it, well, the younger actors here, no, they can't know anything about what happens later on.
No,
but it must be very informative for both yourself, Nick, and Ingrid, when because those characters would have the memory of the things Nisha and Zara Devlin, who plays Margaret, are playing
Out. I mean, Nisha and I weren't cast exclusively for our teeth, but we have fabulous teeth, this is true. but there is it is actually incredibly useful. I've never done it before, you know, where you have your younger self in the room with you.
And you can see the things
the
that
mistakes
you
were making or what you were doing. It's kind of like it's hilarious, you know. Yeah. But actually, Nisha's so chatty. We chat about it, and we're building one character.
That's
which is really strange. Yeah. It's a very unusual experience, isn't
it? It's brilliant. And like one of the really fascinating things, Sean, is that if I'm sitting out and Nick and Ingrid are working on the floor, that you can watch and there's now little echoes of stuff that we're doing. Yeah. And it's because we're starting to get to know each other really well and we're spending so much time together that there's physical echoes. And then there's also Abby has it written in so cleverly as well that there's echoes of the same lines and stuff like that. That the physical echoes are really fascinating to be exploring as well.
And I'm not surprised, Nick, you mentioned that... I can't remember the name of the physical movement theatre company that
Frantic Assembly.
Assembly. That the physical movement was part of all of this, and it's David Bulger, of course, artistic director of Cushcame Dance Theatre, who's directing here.
Yeah.
Directing. I think it's his first time directing a play, although there has often been text in many of his dance works. Yeah. But physical movement is hugely important in this. There are times when a character goes into a room. And it's the older character, and then the younger character walks out of the room.
Exactly.
Kind of the dance of that is very important.
It is a dance, and of course, I mean the wonderful thing about working with David, I don't know what it is. He's a proper artist. Mm. He really is. He totally gets what he's doing. And when he doesn't know, he says, and then we all help him out, and he helps us out. And so we're real collaboration all the time. It's just been just so much fun, which incidentally is what he said on day one. He wants it to be fun, and it has been. It's just been joyous, the whole process. But his physical language that he has is completely different to mine, you know, but he's speaking. He uses it to speak. So that when you're putting a phone down on a desk, it isn't just, I'm not just putting a phone down on a desk. It means something to the other person. So it's like you're probably familiar with this, you know, that every line that you say has to have some action, activity in it, because you're doing something to the other person. Well, all the props do this as well. All the costumes do this. All the music does this. The set itself is a character in the piece, and it starts to kind of... So all of these things are layering.
Yeah, I think you were particularly taken by that as well, Nisha, this idea that, you know, the physical placing of a spoon or a cup or whatever it might be is very important. But it did strike me about the language of this, even though now there are a couple of big speeches for various characters that do get sometimes they're wordy. But for the most part, these are like they're ordinary conversations.
Absolutely.
You know, what time will you be home at this evening? Do you want... are the birds scratching outside?
Yes,
where's the cat?
Yeah,
I mean, very, very mundane things, but Abby Morgan seems to have invested that mundanity with huge importance.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's isn't it the joy of sometimes is the joy in the pedestrian that it's like, and there's so much subtext going on and what they're saying to each other, and then it can echo off into the other generational scenes.
That's the weird thing. It goes forwards and backwards at the same time.
Yeah.
So there might be a scene of, like, say, Nisha's coming in from, you know, being outside, and then I'm coming in from being outside 20 years, 30 years later. So you've seen him going into the future and me looking back at the past. And there are times when we mix and meld. You know, you must have had that thing where you think, if only I could go back and... just change that one thing I did.
and we had a wonderful moment today in the script that I won't ruin for people, but there was a wonderful moment where Nick does something today that he wishes William hadn't done, but that you have the beautiful realisation in this very small moment that Abby has written in that, of course, he wants to do it and he makes the effort to do it, but he's not able to change the past. And it's those little beautiful nuggets which are gorgeous, I think.
Yeah, the other thing that struck me from the script in that regard, I mean, obviously, there's a big... those with bigger brains can have a long philosophical debate about the nature of time and how linear it is or isn't.
Yeah.
But that also struck me, you know, around the characters themselves. There are two, and I want to be very careful how I just frame this.
Yeah, yeah.
There are two huge discussions that happen for the couple in terms of the beginning of life and in terms of the end of life. Again, somehow Abby Morgan manages to bring these huge, huge themes into very ordinary conversation.
Very ordinary conversation. And in a way, isn't that what we all want? Do you know what I mean? The ability to be able to talk openly and easily about something and to sort of handle difficult situations in a different way. Mm. But there isn't, I don't think there's a single scene which doesn't have, like, I think she's one of the most perfect writers. She, every scene has an extraordinary beginning, an incredible middle, and an extraordinary end. Mm. So whenever
and the scene might shift from you and Ingrid Craigie as the older couple to Nisha and Zara as the younger couple and back again.
Absolutely. Yeah. And within that, we were talking about today, there's times when, you know, the scene starts and it's really kind of fun and then it goes into something really deep and profound and meaningful, which is about the changing of state of life or something like that. But she always leaves you with a joke or something funny. There's always, and that's what I found very appealing, this whole idea that you're continually kind of asked to enjoy your life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is what the play really, I think, is about. It's about, you know, making sure that you have a good time.
Yeah. And objects are very important in it as well, because we see a birthday party at one point. What age is
28. William is 28.
28 at that point in time. And when we see a present and we see that echoed then later on in the same scene, I think it is, in fact, the two of them, where the older Willie and Maggie are talking about that.
Yeah.
The kind of, so that birthday present carries a huge history within it. Objects seem to be very important.
They are very important. But then again, you know, it's like, it's this idea of the poetry of domesticity.
Mm. Yeah.
There's
and the accessibility of it. That it is human. It is delightful. And little tiny things. I mean, we all know, you know, your mother or your father gave you something and it means something. Mm. Or there's a, you know, a record that you kept. Mm. Or there's a shirt that you love more, and you love it more than the other shirt. What's wrong with the other shirt? Nothing wrong with it. But you love that shirt because it has particular meaning to you. You know, it's that. And she brings those things out all the time with these two people over different paces of different times in their lives, so that they recognize them, and those feelings and thoughts echo and speak to each other all the way through the play.
What stage of rehearsals are you at this point, Nisha?
We are the middle of week three of 5 weeks.
So at the moment, it's all good.
It's all good.
I haven't started to doubt anything yet, have you?
No, not yet.
That's next week's work.
That's next week's work. You're giving away things.
Well, listen, great to speak with both of you. I must say the script itself is very exciting, and you all seem perfectly cast, Nick and Nick Dunning and Ingrid Craigie as the older couple, Nisha Dunbar and Zara Devlin as the younger couple. But thanks to both you, Nick and Nisha, for coming into us this evening. Love Song by Abby Morgan. Previews at the Gate Theatre. That's from the 9th of May. It opens then on the 14th of May and runs through until the 15th of June. GateTheatre.ie for full details. Internationally renowned clarinetist Julian Bliss makes his debut with the RTE Concert Orchestra on Thursday, May the 8th at the National Concert Hall as part of Mozart Masterpieces. Bliss will perform Mozart's Clarinet Concerto in A Major, a work widely considered as one of the finest ever written for the instrument and the composer's final completed instrumental piece. Known for his versatility across classical, chamber and jazz music, Bliss has performed since childhood, continues to inspire a new generation of clarinetists with his expressive performances. Delighted to be joined on the line this evening by Julian Bliss. The Mozart Clarinet Concerto, it's extraordinary. The clarinet was such a young instrument when Mozart wrote this piece, Julian, and in fact he wrote it for a slightly lower version of the clarinet, but boy did he know how to show the instrument that you play off.
Good evening. Yeah, thank you very much. Really looking forward to the concert. And it was a, a very new instrument, and the person it was written for was working, Stadler was working with some instrument makers to develop this new instrument that had an extended range. And so, yeah, Mozart wrote for that that instrument. Mm. And it fits very well for the instrument. And, yeah, it's masterfully written. I mean, sort of it goes to show his genius. But with the extra range, it really gives a whole new flavor to the piece, actually. And it then makes it very operatic in some ways. It's great.
It really does ask the clarinet player to almost sing the part that the clarinet has to play. But how did you choose the clarinet as an instrument? I believe it happened very young, and you were quite definite from the outset. No history of clarinet playing. In fact, very little history of music, I think, within your family. But the minute you picked up this instrument, you knew.
I did, yes. And you're right, not a huge history of music in the family. And I expressed an interest in playing music when I was four. And, tried a handful of different instruments, and none of them really grabbed me. But when they put a clarinet in my hand for the first time, within seconds, I decided that was what I wanted to play. And I always enjoyed it more than anything else, and still do.
And did you, what kind of sound did you make at that first moment? It's not the easiest instrument to get your first sound out of.
Probably not a great one, but I've always been fairly determined, and I took lessons straight away. And so I think that really helped me get into some good habits from the off, and learn how to. Yeah, like you say, it's not one of the easiest to get a nice sound out of. But it took a little bit. But
took a little bit of time. But mind you say you picked up the instrument at four and it was love at first sight. Perhaps not love at first sound, but quite quickly you got used to the sound. But at the age of six, you were performing for the English royal family, the British royal family. I mean, you clearly had reached a very high standard very quickly, and I know you hate the term prodigy, but how on earth did you get to that level so quickly? I mean, who was helping you get there?
Well, I mean, like I say, I took lessons straight away, and I just had very lucky to have fantastic people around me, and I loved it as well, more than anything. They'd have to sort of prize it out of my hands, really. And it became that performing and playing in front of people was what made me the happiest. And so therefore I'd spend as much time as I possibly could practicing and playing the instrument. And yeah, I mean, to have the opportunities to perform, and for example, the royal family, you can't get much bigger than that, was incredible. And looking back, unbelievable almost.
You were six at the time, so you may not have had the good sense to be nervous at that moment in time, or you may have been indifferent to it in some ways. But you did, I think, later on, and I think it is perhaps one of your favorite, most favorite moments, play for the late Queen Elizabeth II. Mm-hmm. You played the entire clarinet concerto. Now, nerves might have been, you might have been at the point in your life when you knew what nerves are when you did that particular performance.
Well, certainly when you're young, I think there's a certain sense of fearlessness and naivety, really. Mm. But it meant actually that I never got nervous, even as I got older. That was something that stayed with me. I always just loved being on stage and really enjoyed it. And yes, there was adrenaline, but it was always excitement for me to get out there. But yeah, to play the Mozart for Queen Elizabeth II was, I mean, incredible. Words that I can't really find the right words to describe that.
Let's have a listen to some of the concerto just to get a sense of how the instrument is treated. And you chose a couple of sections and quite kindly told specifically where we might come in on the various tracks, because there is quite a long orchestral introduction to the piece to let you get yourself settled in if you are the soloist. But then about 2 minutes in, the orchestra goes very quiet and we get to hear the clarinet restating some of the tunes that we've just heard. There we have it, a section from the opening movement of Mozart's Clarinet Concerto, the piece that Julian Bliss will be playing with the RT Concert Orchestra on May the 8th. But there he was playing it, a recording of Julian playing with the Royal Northern Sinfonia, conducted by Mario Venzago. Even as you listen to that, Julian, you mentioned it. I think you mentioned, you talked about it's almost becomes operatic. It really is the virtuoso aria for the clarinet singer, almost as much as anything else. But the jumps that happen within that, you know, we hear some of those arpeggios where it goes da, 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 right down to the very bottom of the instrument, and the very next note is right up at the top of the instrument. Mozart is demanding.
It is, yeah. It's not an easy piece to play, even though we hope that the end result sounds effortless to the audience. There are, yes, a lot of challenges. And like you say, going from one extreme of the instrument in terms of range to the other. And that sort of highlights, like you say, the operatic different characters almost, maybe within a story. But yeah, it's not an easy one.
The second movement, I think everybody knows, or lots of people will know and love this particular movement. They may not even know from where they know it, but a lot of people will mention out of Africa the minute you hear this movement. Let's listen to you then. And there's no rest for the wicked on this one. It's Mr. or Ms. Clarinet Player, straight in, please, for movement two. Julian Bliss with the opening section there of the second movement of Mozart's Clarinet Concerto, and that in a recording featuring the Royal Northern Sinfonia, conducted by Mario Venzaga. Julian will be playing the work with the RTE Concert Orchestra on May the 8th at the National Concert Hall, and he's speaking to me on Arena this evening. It may be naive of me to suggest this, Julian, but when you listen to that piece as a listener, you think, that's fairly straightforward. It's a nice, simple tune. Yeah. It's moving at a gentle pace. You know, even that little last section we heard is just, it's almost like a scale, a slow scale going downwards, then a note higher, slow scale going downwards, et cetera, et cetera. But yes. I guess sometimes the simple is the most difficult thing to attain.
Yeah, precisely. Therein lies the challenge. And you haven't got any virtuosic passages to hide behind. It's the most difficult things actually for a musician. It's making a very beautiful sound, lovely legato, and bringing character and emotion to a very simple phrase, and that's a very challenging thing to do. So yeah, you're not flying around on the instrument, but there are other areas that are very, very difficult at times, but very rewarding as well.
And I would have thought, having your breath under control is absolutely vital, particularly for that slow adagio movement.
For sure.
The other aspects of the clarinet, I wonder to what extent you have explored them within your own musical life. Obviously, there's the classical side of the repertoire, but there is quite a large jazz repertoire for the instrument as well. You probably weren't aware of that at the age of four. Did it become part of your musical relationship with the instrument as time went on, Julian?
It did. I didn't start to really listen to jazz or the clarinet in jazz until I was maybe 7 or 8. And then it seemed something quite different to what I was doing. So never really considered it in some ways. And it wasn't until I was much older that I actually started to think about playing some jazz. You know, there's a lot of fantastic pieces of music that cross those boundaries, whether that's Copland or Gershwin. And so playing some of that music really helped me to sort of get that, the jazz understanding and sort of sensibilities. And yeah, I mean, now I love playing jazz. In some ways completely different, but also rewarding.
I was speaking with an Irish musician, Neil Martin, last night, and he plays cello, but he plays cello both as a classical instrument and within Irish traditional music. Right. And he was talking about, you know, the crossover and the various aspects of that. Is it a very different style that you have to, a very different way of even blowing the instrument that you have to use when playing jazz as opposed to classical?
Not massively. Most of the difference comes in the knowledge of the harmony. And yes, I mean, there are some small changes that you do on a setup or an equipment level, but I think a lot of it, there are more similarities than there are differences, put it that way. And of course the improvisation, yes, you can be a bit more free and a bit more wild at times with your sound and your interpretation, but it's quite similar, I think.
All right, I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm not going to play the section that you suggested from the third movement. I just want people to think, in case they think, oh, sure, it's all lovely, big, slow legato phrases like we heard in the second movement. Here's how the third movement starts. Little section there from the opening of the third movement of Mozart's Clarinet Concerto, which Julian Bliss will be playing with the RTE Concert Orchestra on May the 8th. Interesting, Julian, this is part, and I know you're playing the solo, the concerto role, obviously, but this is part of an all-Mozart night where we will hear Mozart's final symphony. We've referred to the fact that this was the Clarinet Concerto is one of Mozart's final instrumental works. To be performing it within that kind of context and to the Magic Flute Overture, I think it is, and one of the other operatic overtures is in there as well. To be performing it within that context, will that feel different for you, or do you just concentrate on your bit and have to let the other bits alone?
It doesn't feel different. I think it's great though to have an all Mozart program and to sort of show his genius in different areas, whether that's, you know, the opera side, the symphonies and the concerto, and to hear the similarities within, but also the differences as well. So yeah, it's a fantastic, really varied program, and there's lots of people to hear, some that they will know and some maybe they haven't heard before.
Absolutely, and I suppose the different feeling will be for the audience as they listen. Julian, thanks so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
That's Julian Bliss, clarinetist, who will be playing as part of Mozart Masterpieces Thursday, May the 8th at 8 p.m. in the National Concert Hall. The RTE Concert Orchestra, conducted by Svan van Rechem on the night. I think is it his debut with the orchestra as well. The Overture to the Magic Flute, Overture to the what's the word for a kidnapping from the Seraglio? I can't think of the word right now. The Clarinet Concerto in A Major and Symphony No. 41, Jupiter. Murder, the pieces that the RTE Concert Orchestra will be playing on the night. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched the abduction from the Seraglio was the word I was searching for. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Harry Buchlis was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.